Hello and welcome to This Must Be Talking Heads, the show where I go track by track, album by album, through the band's music and discuss their inspiration and impact. I'm Rodney, your host, and thanks for joining me for another journey through one of the band's highest selling albums. That success was mostly driven by some hit singles and a shitload of play on MTV. I'm talking, of course, about the band's sixth studio album, Little Creatures, that was released in June 1985. And this is very exciting for me. Before we go any further, I should mention that I am joined this week by a very special guest, someone who found some time in his schedule to sit down for a chat about all things Talking Heads.
Hi, I'm Jerry Harrison, and you probably know me because I was a member of the Talking Heads. You might know me because I was a member of the Modern Lovers. You also might know me because my solo band Casual Gods had a hit song in Australia, Rev It Up.
That's right. I recently caught up with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Jerry Harrison to get some updates on what he's been up to lately, reflect on his amazing career as a solo artist and producer, and to get some insights into this album. So you'll be hearing clips from that interview with Jerry throughout the next couple of episodes. Fresh in everyone's mind is the band's recent Lifetime Achievement honour at the 2021 Grammys. So I started by asking Jerry what it was like for the band to finally receive the only major accolade that, until now, had eluded them.
We got a Grammy for the cover of Speaking in Tongues that Robert Rauschenberg did. I was nominated for a Grammy for Fear of Music for the cover of that. But other than that, we were never nominated for anything, for any of our music. I think that many, many artists look back at the history of the Grammys and, you know, the Rolling Stones, I don't think ever were nominated for a Grammy until Some Girls. So you think about like Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, nothing. So you kind of go, we're in good company that we have been, that somehow missed us, right? That being said, it felt great to get the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I also feel that the Lifetime Achievement Award is sometimes used by the Grammy Foundation as like, there's these fabulous artists that, for one reason or another, when they were in the peak of their powers, I don't know, maybe we were obsessed by Prince then. They never got there. So anyway, I was delighted.
We all know that 2020 was a putrid trash monster of a year. But what made it even worse was the postponement of Jerry's plans to tour around the 40th anniversary of Remain in Light. Last year, when Bonnaroo pivoted to being a streaming festival, Jerry and the others put on a remote, socially distanced mini set of four songs. But I wanted to know if there was still an intention for the full show to return once festivals became feasible again.
For a long time, I felt without style and grace, wearing shoes with no socks. In cold weather, I knew my heart was in the right place. I knew I'd be able to do these things.
I think we're still going to try and make it happen, yeah. You know, we had a whole tour booked here in the United States, and we're starting to look at the rest of the world. The concept was to try to come as close as we could to the Rome 1980 show of the band that had Adrian Belew in it, with Dolette McDonald and Busta Jones and Steve Scales. So, you know, a different band than the Stop Making Sense band, a band that was all that didn't have complex lights, didn't have a big crew. It was just about the music. And it also has, anyone who's ever watched that show, you'll understand that it's not like I'd say it's better than Stop Making Sense, but it rivals it. You know, Adrian Belew is an extraordinary guitar player. And there's also, it's a little more out of control feeling. Like, you know, it's a little bit more spur of the moment. And so I had produced the band Turquoise and sat in with them. And I knew that they already knew a whole bunch of Talking Head songs. I didn't want to have a lot of session players doing this. I wanted to have a band that had their own audience a little bit, but that were up for it. It's not like they're 22, but they're certainly quite a bit younger than I am and than Adrian. And they're also excellent musicians. And, you know, so we had a rehearsal in Nashville where we basically spent the whole day just working on Cross-Eyed and Painless. We opened the door like when we took a little break to go to the bathroom. And it seemed like everybody who had been in all the other sessions were there with their ears pressed against the door. So it was like, I think we did a good enough job that people are going like, wait a moment, could it be, you know? So anyway, I'm really excited about it. And I think festivals are the perfect place to do it. One thing about that music is it doesn't require being in the evening so that you have spectacular lights. It's good time, exciting, intellectually stimulating music that you can listen to at night, and you might have a different feeling sitting down at night than you would in the middle of the afternoon. But within the midst of a festival, everyone goes like, God, this is going to make it a better festival.
That's obviously great news. And unbeknownst to Jerry, when we spoke, Bonnaroo were just days away from announcing that the remaining light set will feature at this year's festival, as long as we get one. So get your tickets early and keep your fingers and toes crossed, and I'll do the same. Like I said earlier, I got enough insights from Jerry to just about write a book. Some of the things that I learned literally blew me away, so you won't want to miss the next episode where I deep dive into his solo work and side projects, because you're in for a real treat, believe me. As far as Little Creatures is concerned, I got Jerry to give me some background on the making of the album and some of the hits that everybody knows and loves, so I'll share those here and a lot more as we explore the album in full, which I'll do now. In 1984, while audiences were still spellbound with the incredible concert film Stop Making Sense, the band took some time off. By the time they came together to record Little Creatures, they hadn't played together in over a year, and despite all that time apart, things came together incredibly quickly. Most of the album was recorded in just 2 weeks at Sigma Sound Studios in New York City. So how on earth did they get an album together so damn quickly? The main reason was that, unlike their last few albums, David had been writing songs on his own, working up little demos at home, usually with a guitar, his voice, and a drum machine. And now you might be thinking, well, wait a second, surely writing songs on your own is only going to increase the self-imposed pressure, especially for someone renowned for his writer's block like David is. Well, I can't honestly say that I know, but here's a clip of David talking about why he liked writing with his mechanical writing partner.
I have a drum machine here. So a lot of people write songs with these. Not everybody. I don't write every song with a drum machine, but a lot of songs I do write with one. And I'm definitely not alone. I think it's... for a lot of people, it expresses whatever we would call it, the primacy of the groove, or the groove as being a very important element in the music. Sometimes you start with something like that, and then you start playing along, and pretty soon you add the chord changes or whatever. And
is it as simple as just turning the machine on and just kind of punching some stuff up and waiting till you get a groove that hits you?
Just about.
Yeah.
I think what it does is it takes you out. You get you in a minor kind of trance state. You know, this repetitive rhythm and whatnot. It gets you into a little bit outside of altered state or whatever. Kind of like driving a car, and I find driving a car is a good time to think of song lyrics, because your conscious mind is occupied by something else, by steering, hopefully, and so your unconscious, or whatever you want to call it, the gift or whatever, is allowed to come through unfiltered.
Most of the songs on Little Creatures and the follow-up album True Stories existed in some form or another for quite a while before they were recorded. We know this because the band have said so, but also there's a collection of demos that has since been released on the internet. They're known colloquially as the True Creatures demos. And if you've never heard of them, you don't have to worry, because we're going to be hearing little grabs from all of them as we go through the next two albums. According to David, the idea of taking pre-written songs to the other band members didn't go down too well at first. Luckily, the songs were fun and kind of charming, and after all, this was the old cliche of getting the band back together, so attention quickly turned to making the best record that they possibly could. Probably the most noteworthy change on this album is the intentional return to the sound of a four-piece band, leaving the expanded Talking Heads lineup behind them. Here's a clip of David explaining some of his thinking about why they did that.
It seems like we can't go on just trying to get bigger and bigger. That's kind of a dead end. And it would cost a lot of money, too.
Little Creatures was a huge departure from the band's previous work. The goal was to do something different, to strip things back, move beyond weird screeching sounds, and lay something down that's closer to a traditional pop record, albeit pop with a Talking Heads twist. At the time, David described the songs as very conventional, except probably the words are a little unusual. And in another interview, Tina said, "When we got back together, there was a feeling of having come full circle, We were just four people singing some easy, simple songs with no pretension of being avant-garde. As usual, a few different album titles were being kicked down the road before they finally found one that fit. Tina had a fondness for the title Wild Infancy, while another early title was In Defense of Television, before they finally settled on Little Creatures, that name being lifted from the lyrics of the track Creatures of Love. At around the time that the album was coming together, David had moved into a swanky loft in Manhattan's Soho district. In the same building as him was the Phyllis Kind Gallery, and through connections there, David was able to reach out to an artist named Reverend Howard Finster. He was a painter and a self-ordained minister of what he called the Folk Art Church. Having already designed a cover for REM, David commissioned Finster to paint something for the Little Creatures cover with more or less a free rein. Finster delivered his customary mix of people, landscapes, buildings, and words, all presented from a variety of perspectives. All the band members are present in the scene, with David at the bottom, in his underwear, carrying the world on his shoulders. His representation is both undignified and glorified at the same time. Of course, Rolling Stone voted it best album cover of the year. On the back cover, we get the band members standing in what resembles some kind of lineup. Presumably they're all being arrested for crimes against fashion. Everyone is wearing the loudest, most ridiculous pieces of clothing they could find, and the result looks like an explosion in a 60s wallpaper factory. Chris said that they looked like they were all from another dimension. Jerry described the look as being closer to something from a Hungarian circus. Even though the result looks like some kind of optical illusion, you can also read the photo shoot as being whimsical. It's almost like some kids got into their parents' wardrobe and dressed up in the wildest fashions that they could find. And in that way, the photo is announcing a kind of purity and innocence, and that, again, the band is eschewing pretension. So in that sense, the picture couldn't be better. That's probably enough of a preamble from me, so without further ado, we should get into the music itself. First up is a real classic, a fan favourite. Here's the album opener, And She Was. Hard to believe that you haven't heard this song after about 35 years as an FM radio staple, but it's probably one of only a handful of Talking Heads hits that sounds as fresh now as it did when it was written. Let's deconstruct this song a little and look at the timeline of things. On earlier albums, the music came before the lyrics, so when I've broken down the songs, I've tried to follow that same logical order. This time the song came first, so I'll start with the lyrics and I'll go from there. In the last episode, I explained that as of 1985, Talking Heads weren't a touring act anymore. That meant that the band members were sort of scrounging around and working on various bits and pieces themselves. Except for David, who had a big ambition to write and direct his own feature film, and that would eventually become the movie True Stories. You probably know that Talking Heads also released an album called True Stories right after this one, but what you may not know is that all of the songs for True Stories and Little Creatures were written and recorded at pretty much the same time. Here's a clip from my interview with Jerry, where we talk about how David's approach to True Stories affected the songs on this record, and how it laid out a new musical frontier for the band to explore.
Little Creatures were the outtakes of the songs that David was writing for True Stories. And yet I do think it's a superior album by actually quite a long shot. When we mixed Little Creatures, at the same time, we rehearsed all the basic tracks for all the songs for True Stories and recorded them in between our mixes. It was a great way to make a record. It's like, you know, you're really efficient. You're practicing out in the other room when a mixing engineer is working on it. You go in and listen to it. Go back out there, practice. Here's the mix, it's done. Okay, let's record that song. Okay, on to the next. And David had very deliberately, because of the nature of what he wanted to do with True Stories, had written his version of sort of Americana, is what I would call it. So the songs are not as polyrhythmic, they're not as contrapuntal, they don't require so many people to play. They're a little more straightforward. There was a sense of it wanting to just be straightforward, but also maybe a little more pop, you know, and I think we really accomplished that.
So starting with And She Was and then going throughout the whole Little Creatures album, this is Talking Heads doing pop. And I might be making connections where no connections exist. It certainly wouldn't be the first time. But I remembered a live show where David introduced And She Was, and that word pop came up again.
This next song was written about a girl I knew in high school who used to do a lot of LSD. And she used to lie in a field by a factory that made soft drinks. Soda. Pop.
So maybe David sat down to write a pop song, and through the magic of free association, he started dreaming of a soda pop factory. And that triggered a memory of a girl that he was in love with. She would trip on LSD while he stayed planted on the ground, wishing that she'd stay down on his level. In other places, David had said that the girl who inspired the song would actually lie behind a factory that made Yoo-hoo chocolate milk drinks. But rather than focusing on the beverage, it's probably more productive to look at the setting and the characters of the song and how the songwriting has matured from the early Talking Heads days. Also, you've got to love a song lyric that starts with "and." It feels like you're eavesdropping on someone else telling a story that they're already halfway through, like you've missed out on some information that came earlier. Sometimes writers will even write out song lyrics and then cross out certain lines to help express the core essence of the feeling without being too explicit. That might be what happened here. As it turns out, David had been wrestling with this song for a little while, which is interesting because it sounds deceptively simple. In an interview with Spin magazine from June 1985, David said this: "I wanted to write a song about a girl who can float. The song is called And She Was. The words were written in bits and pieces over the last year and a half. 2 months ago, I tried putting the words to different kinds of music. I'd put words to music in one style, listen to it, and rewrite it, put it in another style, listen to it, and rewrite it." On the 2005 reissue of Little Creatures, we were treated to an early take of this song. It doesn't have the gentle guitar arpeggio at the start yet, and a few lyrics are missing here and there, but you can hear what's coming together. As the song approaches its final form, you can see how the approach to this album is affecting the music. Brian Eno's not here to write additional complicated keyboard or guitar parts. There's a quiet confidence to the songwriting, and they're not leaning too heavily on external talent to bring this song to life. If you need backing vocals, well, let's just see if Jerry and Tina can do it. There's a sweetness to this song that, to some degree, has been missing from the band's repertoire up until this point. Similarly, the songwriting takes us to a place that's a little more relatable, at least on this track. Highways and factories and houses still feature, but the perspective on them is not so much as an outsider anymore. Instead, they gently recess into the background, and a new emotional truth is uncovered. Also, Steve Scales was brought in to add cowbell to this song, so I'll just leave a couple of seconds here for you to make your own joke about that. And She Was reached number 54 on the Billboard singles charts, but it did a little better in the UK, making it into the top 20. And if you're like me and you just can't get enough of this song, there is an extended remix that adds a whopping 23 seconds. Although it was a moderate performing single, it might have slipped by completely without an arresting music video for MTV to play. By the time And She was released, David was heavily distracted with his film project, and the other band members were strewn across the country. Getting together to lip-sync in front of a camera didn't really seem practical, and yet they needed something for TV. And then David saw a 10-minute short film by Portland filmmaker Jim Blashfield called Suspicious Circumstances. In the animated film, clearly inspired by Terry Gilliam from Monty Python, a collage of images is used to portray a surrealistic scene where coffee cups, hands, and even the head of Donald Duck float around an apartment. It's very surreal, but it's very cool, and it has super cool music, and you can go and watch it on YouTube, so you should go and do that right after you listen to this, of course. Anyway, it seemed like Blashfield could deliver exactly what the band needed. So David reached out and shared some of their rough storyboards and told him to more or less do whatever he wanted. And just like that, only 4 weeks later, they got themselves a hit music video that was nominated for Best Group and Best Concept Video at the MTV Music Awards. After working with Talking Heads, Blashfield went on to make pioneering music videos with other incomparable artists like Michael Jackson, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush, and Weird Al Yankovic. And since we're talking about Weird Al, and I know I've mentioned this before, but And She Was is yet another one of the Talking Heads songs that Weird Al drew from for his stylistic parody of the band, which was called Dog Eat Dog. In fact, Weird Al's song is kind of built around the exact same style and feeling as And She Was. So Little Creatures comes out of the gate pretty strong, and while we're still vibing on And She Was, I do want to move on to the next track on the album, which is Give Me Back My Name. There's a bit of a shadow cast over this song, and it's a very long shadow that perhaps originates with Fear of Music. Although it's a bit rough and ready, this is the first song that we can hear an early demo of. And again, this was recorded when David was writing a bunch of songs for True Stories, and you can hear how the core of the tune didn't change too much.
Some things can never be spoken. Some things cannot be known. Word does not exist in any language, it will never be uttered by a human.
Almost every song on Little Creatures is credited to David Byrne, except for this one and Lady Don't Mind, which are accredited to all four band members. Ironically, despite earning a songwriting credit himself, Chris France said that this song never really clicked with him. He called it kind of whiny and sad and said, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, that he wished they'd never recorded it. Even if you don't fully grasp what the lyrics to this one mean, and I'm certain that I don't, you can still feel something anthropological and indigenous is just yearning to be expressed. You sense a struggle and someone being denied something about their identity and their connection to the past. One theory that I found online that makes the most sense to me started with unpacking the following lines. Sometimes people who are illiterate will sign their name with just an X. But the reference to X is probably a reference to Malcolm X. He was born Malcolm Little, but he started using X as a stand-in for his unknown African ancestral name. In fact, sometimes he was known by just X. A radical proponent for racial justice by any means necessary, he was assassinated in February 1965. And rumors that local law enforcement aided the assassination have persisted for decades. With the recording of Little Creatures continuing right up until March of 1985, it's at least feasible that the 20th anniversary of the death of Malcolm X was the inspiration for this song. Well, I've managed to depress myself, so it's time to lift the mood a little with a reminder that we are, all of us, creatures of love. I'm always curious about songs that lend an album its title. That's what we get with Creatures of Love. It feels like the artist really wants us to pay attention to that song, and it becomes kind of overdetermined whether they want it to or not. Creatures of Love, paired with another song, Stay Up Late, makes up the whimsical, humanistic spine of the record. And for this song, everything gets thrown in the pot. It's a bit country, you can't really dance to it, but you can certainly tap your toes. And because we're talking about sex, of course, David brings his unique perspective to the table. Here's a clip of Tina recounting the first time that David explained the concept to the band.
You should tell him about what David...
What about Creatures of
what
Love?
What David was telling us about, oh, I've written this song. I want to tell you about it. He was very excited. He says, it's a country song, and it's about when a man and a woman lie in bed and make love. When they lift the sheets off, suddenly the bed is covered with little creatures, like, not babies, but fully formed, grown-up little creatures about 6 inches high, like running all over the bed. So we said, oh, right, David, okay.
Okay, yeah.
But then it turned out we really liked the song.
From the sleep of reason, a life is born. We are creatures of love.
There's no doubt in my mind that the Sleep of Reason that David mentions is a reference to an etching by 18th century Spanish artist Francisco Goya called The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters. The etching depicts Goya asleep at his easel, surrounded by owls and other sinister-looking figures from Spanish folktales. For Goya, the abandonment of reason and rational thought is what allows the evil and the corrupt to rule. For David, The Sleep of Reason is more about losing yourself during sex, turning your brain off, and how it's not only fun, but vital to our existence. I don't know about you, but I find David's idea a little more comforting. Creatures of Love is also notable for the pedal steel guitar playing of Eric Weisberg, who is an acclaimed American instrumentalist, and even if you don't know the name Eric Weisberg, I guarantee you know his work. And if you're not sure where, I'll give you a hint. Immortalized by the movie Deliverance, Eric Weisberg's Dueling Banjos is an iconic tune, and his pedal steel guitar playing on Creatures of Love helps dial up the color and vitality of the tune. I can only imagine how excited the band were as he laid down this guitar line.
We are creatures of love. We are creatures of love. We are creatures of love.
Up next, one of my favourites from not just this album, but the band's entire back catalogue. This is Lady Don't Mind. Could rightly say that And She Was and Road to Nowhere are a bit overplayed. Lady Don't Mind still feels fresh, and it's a song that's not pretending to be anything that it isn't. Once again, we have the chance to dip into the well of demos from this time period, and there's something really charming about David's early vision for Lady Don't Mind, even in demo form. There's a little guitar intro, it's almost like a flamenco-influenced melody that was abandoned for the stripped-back version on the album. Demo for Lady Don't Mind has a confidence and a completeness that's lacking from some of the other demos from the True Creatures session. That's largely down to the fact that Lady Don't Mind had been kicking around for a couple of years at this point. In fact, it had originally been written in 1982 during the Speaking in Tongues sessions. There's a calmness to this song, and it delivers on the promise of simple tunes done right. We don't quite get a handle on the relationship depicted in the song. There's hints that the titular lady is still a bit of a puzzle for the protagonist, but at least this relationship is joyous and familiar territory. One music critic even referenced the opening song from the 77 album by saying that this song is like When Love Comes to Town, but without the uh-oh. David repeats the phrase uh-oh towards the end of the song, but it's devoid of panic. It feels a bit like being tipped off your feet in slow motion.
Uh-oh!
pretty stripped back song. It's funny that there's so many remixes and alternate versions floating around. I figured that Jerry might have been behind them all, given his background in production, but when I asked him about it, he said that it was more to do with the record label than anything else.
I'm not even sure I've heard a lot, because it was part of the international effort. And so why you would have gotten it, because we were on EMI for the rest of the world, and we were on Warner Brothers for North America. And they really saw something in the Ladies Don't Mind. And there. So E.T. and I did some remixes, but I believe that they hired some other people too.
Clocking in at almost 7 minutes, the extended mix of Lady Don't Mind gives us a chance to highlight David's unusual little vocal noises here. He might have traded yelps and squawking for crooning, but he still knows how to set himself apart from traditional vocalists. And if you frequent the corners of the internet where Talking Heads memes are dreamt up, you'll see lots of little references to David's cute little beep 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 noises. Another version of Lady Don't Mind, called the Moog March version, was dug up for a rarities compilation, and you can hear on this one that some of the lyrics still haven't settled and it has a much more jittery, jumpy energy, and in fact, I can't rule out that this isn't the take from those speaking in tongues sessions. Having lived with Lady Don't Mind for a long time before finally nailing it, it's difficult to gauge what the band makes of the song. I can only look back at it as a radio hit from when I was a kid, so you'd assume that they were pretty happy with how it turned out. But when I asked Jerry about that, he painted a completely different picture. As it turns out, they weren't even thinking of it as a single, let alone as the album's lead-off single.
The Lady Don't Mind was picked by EMI to be our first single, which surprised us. We wouldn't have thought of it as being first single material. And that's why we did a video to it. And I had gone to our manager, Gary Kerfers, and I said, you know, David did a video with Tony Basil for Once in a Lifetime. And then he with Julia McFarlane did Burning Down the House. And I don't remember who did This Must Be the Place with Dave. And I just said, we're a band, Gary. And one of the things about being a band is we all have creative ideas. David's remarkable, but I don't want him to suddenly own to be the only video maker, and that we're suddenly pawns or actors in his visual vision. You know, so I said, tell Warner Brothers we have to make 4 videos. He goes, they'll never go for that. And I said, well, then tell them we're not giving them the album. And he's like, oh my God, like artists, you know. So he came back, he goes, I got you 3, but you have to do them for $40,000 each. And fortunately, we knew people that would work so that we could actually pull that off. And the first one was to be the Lady Don't Mind. So Christine and David and I, we embraced this, and we all drew storyboards for the list of songs that we thought we were going to do. 3 songs. So it was Road to Nowhere, Stay Up Late, and the Lady Don't Mind. So it ended up that my storyboards, with some additional storyboards that Tina had come up with, were combined to make the video for The Lady Don't Mind. And then I was good friends with Jim Jarmusch, so I asked him to be the director. And it was also, we were releasing it in the summertime, and I think that they wanted to come with the more powerful song in the fall.
So independent filmmaker Jim Jarmusch was commissioned to direct the music video. By that time, Jarmusch had released his debut feature, Permanent Vacation, and a follow-up called Stranger Than Paradise, but he had never directed a music video before. That said, Jarmusch understood music at a deep level. He'd integrated revered tunes like Screamin' Jay Hawkins' I Put a Spell on You into his films, just to let everybody know that although he was art house, he was also eclectic.
I put a spell on you.
Jarmusch brought his unique visual style to the Lady Don't Mind video by setting it in New York, which allowed for lots of lonely, existential shots of the Big Apple. The band members all appear in a grey industrial space that's mostly shot in black and white, either informally playing their instruments and singing, or sometimes there's these long shots where one band member moves very slowly while the others spin around very fast. There's even one take where Jerry falls over, so it must have been a tough day on set. And for the rest of the video, a mysterious blonde woman whose face we never see walks around an unfurnished apartment in a kimono. She doesn't seem to mind, and so I guess we shouldn't either. As a single, Lady Don't Mind went to number 24 on the Australian singles charts. It snuck into the top 10 in New Zealand, but it didn't really trouble the charts in the US or the UK. That combined with the fact that EMI had pressured the band to release it as the first single, and you can maybe understand why the song has been kind of overlooked over the years. David doesn't play it live, and it's not even on the best of Talking Heads, despite being one of my favourites. Anyway, here to round out Side A of Little Creatures is Perfect World. Being so straightforward musically, I don't have a lot to pick apart here, although in his book Remain in Love, Chris does explain some of the percussion on the track, specifically the contribution of Nana Vasconcelos, who played something called a water drum. They're usually made out of wood and ceramics, and they're filled with water to give it that resonant sound. Water drums are found in both American Indian, but also African music. Interestingly, Chris also contributed some of the lyrics to this track. In an interview with Spin, David Byrne said, "I was looking through some old lyrics and I found two couplets that Chris had written years ago. I changed a few of the words, it had a bit of a bizarre quality that I really liked, so I paired them with some other words that I'd written and that became Perfect World." Chris would later confirm that the original lyrics were from a song that he wrote called Perfect World, Perfect Girl. And the line about riding on an incline was written while riding the train up and down steep hills in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And for that contribution, Chris earns a co-writing credit on this track. Perhaps channeling that Perfect World, Perfect Girl vibe, towards the end of the song, you can hear a few little glimpses of a saxophone, courtesy of SNL bandleader Lenny Pickett. And there's one last thing that I learned about Perfect World during my research, and it's really one of those once you hear it, you can't unhear it kind of things. If you've seen the HBO show Boardwalk Empire or seen the 2013 Superman movie Man of Steel where he plays Zod, you wouldn't have missed the actor Michael Shannon. He's a towering man with wide, intense eyes and a jawline that looks like a dresser with the bottom drawer open. On an old podcast called Liner Notes, which I'm not really sure is around anymore, Shannon paints a pretty grim picture of his childhood before illustrating the moment that Talking Heads came into his life. Okay, so you get the idea. He likes the album. Looking for ways to talk about the album, he starts listing off the names of the songs, and then something incredible happens. Again, remember this guy played Zod in the Superman movie. I told you it was wild. Not to ride on Michael Shannon's coattails too much, I have to say though that although Little Creatures isn't my favourite Talking Heads album, revisiting it recently certainly did wonders for my mood. The world of this album is much happier than some other albums, and sometimes you just have to let the music in. Alright, let's flip the tape over and get into side B with another bouncy tune called Stay Up Late. It's almost impossible to hear this song and not assume that it was inspired by Crescentina's newly minted family. Written from the perspective of a young child who suddenly finds themselves with a baby brother, perhaps a sequel to Creatures of Love, the child finds itself having so much fun that they want to keep the baby up all night long. If there's any deeper meaning to the lyrics, it kind of evades me. It's perhaps the most straightforward song on the album, and maybe in the entire Talking Heads catalogue. It has a lyrical repetitiveness that I personally find a little bit grating, but to give it its due, not everything needs to have hidden meanings and references to 18th century artists. Part of the legacy that this song leaves is that it was deemed worthy for a music video. Long before Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon turned everybody onto the wonders of wire work, Talking Heads were bobbing up and down on wires, all in matching white jumpsuits that were, from all reports, incredibly uncomfortable. In keeping with their whimsical ethos, there's no fancy tricks to make it appear as though the band are flying or anything. The reality is just right there for everybody to see. It's a bit like watching a marionette.
If you allow certain things to be seen, then it's like saying to people, we're not trying to trick you. It's kind of like saying, you can be comfortable with us, we're human, and we're going to show you kind of how the trick's done and where the wires are.
When I interviewed Chris last year, he told me that he remembered being horrifically sick during the shooting for this. So just imagine that as you watch him lurching towards the ceiling and then plummeting towards the ground. Hope they had plenty of Kleenex on standby. Truth be told, the video is actually pretty innocuous. Stay Up Late isn't thought of as a huge hit or anything. It certainly isn't a mainstay of radio of the level of And She Was or Lady Don't Mind. When I spoke to Jerry though, he pointed out just how important all these music videos were in driving record sales.
You know, Little Creatures for many years was our biggest selling album, and we never toured for it. But the momentum of Stop Making Sense, plus the fact that we had these four videos in the can, so to speak, meant that video stations, I'm most aware, of course, of what MTV did, there was always another one to go to. So we ended up being on MTV for an entire year with the four videos. And so therefore, you know, our presence was really there.
Finally, this song was the inspiration for a children's book that was co-written by David Byrne and illustrator Myra Kullman. The pair worked together recently on the companion book to David Byrne's American Utopia tour, and her husband, Thibault Kullman, had worked on some Talking Heads album art. In the children's book, Stay Up Late, two siblings get into various mischievous situations as they try and keep their baby brother awake. There's even some childish musings about some of the peculiar situations you find yourself in as a kid, like these. When I was a kid, the whole family would join my little sister and we'd all eat baby food. When I was a kid, my sister and I would sneak out of the house without any clothes on and go and sit on the neighbor's steps. When I was a kid, my little sister would cover herself with stamps. All right, let's turn the page on Stay Up Late and move on to the next song, which is Walk It Down. This is the only song on the album that bears any resemblance to the style of Speaking in Tongues. Although it's not a driving dance song, there's little echoes of Swamp in the reptilian keyboard line and the repetitive vocals. Looking through the lyrics, it even feels a little bit like I Get Wild, Wild Gravity, where the words are little fragments of loosely related thoughts. There's something in there about a tension between various forms of surrendering and giving in. I'm kind of close to grokking it, but honestly, I can't quite get all the pieces to fit. There's a pretty neat throwback to Once in a Lifetime, thanks to a glowing organ part, and then there's a little chorus, meaning the group of people, not the song structure, and it repeats the Walk It Down line. It all almost feels like an attempt at dressing up a song that's maybe only 4/5 of one. Eric Weisberg returns with some pedal steel guitar, which also suggests they were maybe searching for something that they knew wasn't quite there. Anyway, we better keep going. We've still got two massive songs that finish off Side B to get through, and the first of those is Television Man. SNL sax man Lenny Pickett returns for this epic song about someone who has seemingly been in love with his television. Now they've broken up, but they're still good friends, and at least now he knows his type. Obviously, the working title for this album, In Defense of Television, combined with this song, shows that David had TV on his mind. It's a fascination that'll continue throughout his whole solo career. He seems very weary of TV, but at the same time, he understands that it has such a hold on the common man that it's worth understanding at least what the TV culture is like, and doing so can tell you something about other people and help you connect with them. Here's David dipping into the same well on a track from his solo album, Love This Giant, called I Should Watch TV.
Watch TV. I used to think that it was good for me. Wanted to know what folks were thinking, to understand the land I live in, and I would lose myself and it would set me free.
Television Man is kind of an epic song. In that way, it's kind of the opposite of Walk It Down. There's a lengthy breakdown towards the end, and you can hear Steve Scales absolutely tearing it up as David and his friends on backing vocals are blessed with a generous amount of reverb. This part of the song always gives me a live performance feel. It's as though the song were written to be performed on the stage, or perhaps as a surrogate to make up for the fact that the band weren't going to be on stage anymore. If you were listening to all 6 minutes of Television Man and thinking to yourself, yeah, this is good, but it could use being longer, well, there is an extended mix that adds almost another 2 minutes. That gives all the parts a little bit more room to breathe, and hardcore fans can appreciate everything a little more. Yes, even David's vocals.
World crashes in into my living room. Television made me what I am.
All right, you've waited long enough, and yet again, we've reached the end of the record, and we haven't done a deep dive yet, so for the sake of ceremony and tradition, all that remains is for me to say that your hero track for this episode is, of course, Road to Nowhere. If you follow US politics at all, even from afar, you might know the name Marco Rubio. He's a Republican senator from Florida, and he's kind of a mouthpiece for the conservative right. He's the kind of guy who attacks businesses for taking a stand against things like compulsory masks during a pandemic or the suppression of voter rights. Rubio doesn't hesitate to label progressive companies as woke corporate hypocrites and accuses them of being shills for the communist interests in China. Yeah, Rubio is a real piece of work. Well, back in 2009, after the incumbent Senate Republican Mel Martinez decided not to recontest his seat, Rubio sought the Republican nomination in the Senate. But there was a problem. Because the governor, a fellow Republican named Charlie Crist, also had his eye on the vacant Senate seat. Because he was able to leverage his profile as governor, Crist was able to pull out an early and seemingly unassailable double-digit lead over Rubio for the Republican nomination. But throughout 2009 and into 2010, Rubio's fortunes started to change. What's more, it was no coincidence either. Along with the newly elected President Barack Obama, Governor Crist campaigned on their joint effort to pass a federal stimulus bill. Now, this drew the ire of the well-funded and far-right-leaning group called the Tea Party, who then threw their considerable weight behind Rubio as their preferred candidate. By March 2010, Crist and Rubio were waging an open war against each other through attack ads on TV and online. In one ad, Crist questioned Rubio's use of GOP funds, seemingly for personal services like grocery bills, expensive wine purchases, and even a $134 charge from a local barber, which it was alleged included Rubio getting a full back wax. Rubio returned fire with ads featuring footage of Crist and Obama shaking hands and rhetorically asking viewers the simple question, "Doesn't Florida deserve better?" In a debate televised on Fox News, Rubio tried to take the sting out of the ad war by de-escalating the personal battle and directing the focus back on the people, saying, "This campaign is not about you. It's not about me. It's about the people watching this program." And then adding, "Who do you trust to go to Washington and stand up to Barack Obama?" After the debate, Crist was wounded, but he didn't relent. He doubled down on ads that made wilder and wilder accusations about Rubio, ads that independent analysts would later claim were misleading and in some cases completely untrue. In April 2010, Crist left the Republican Party, handing an open goal to Rubio to claim the party's nomination for Senate in Florida. But Crist still ran as an independent. Although Crist got more votes than the Democratic candidate, Rubio delivered the crushing victory that he and the Tea Party so badly wanted. For Charlie Crist, the Senate run and the ad war that ensued stalled any momentum that his political career had gathered to that point. After some soul-searching, he joined the Democratic Party, and following an unsuccessful tilt for his old job as governor, he was eventually elected to the House of Representatives in Florida's 13th District. But that wasn't the only way that the run for Senate had damaged Charlie Crist. At the height of the ad war in 2010, legal documents were filed alleging that the Crist campaign had committed copyright infringement and false endorsement in an online ad featuring the Talking Heads song, Road to Nowhere. On his website, David Byrne wrote this: "If Crist and his campaign folks had asked to use the song, I would have said no, even if they'd offered a lot of money, such as I've been offered in the past for ad use, although I've always turned those offers down. So my lawyers and I have filed a lawsuit, and we also hope the Republicans might not engage again in this kind of illegal behavior in the future." In April 2011, the lawsuit was finally settled, and although the full details of the settlement weren't disclosed, David and his lawyers had been seeking $1 million in damages. David said he was lucky to be in a position to have what he called the bucks and the guts to stop his music being used against his wishes by politicians for their own political gain.
"Hi, I'm Charlie Crist. During 2010, I ran for a seat in the United States Senate. During that campaign, a video advertisement utilized a song made famous by David Byrne and the Talking Heads called Road to Nowhere."
On the same day that the settlement was announced, Chris released another video on his YouTube channel. As you can tell by the tone, this presumably was part of the settlement.
Regrettably, the campaign did not ask permission to obtain a license from Mr. Byrne to use Road to Nowhere in the advertisement. In fact, Mr. Byrne has never permitted his songs to be used for advertising of any kind, a position I respect deeply. The use of David Byrne's song and his voice in my campaign without his permission was wrong and should not have occurred. I sincerely apologize to David Byrne for using his famous song and his unique voice in my campaign advertisement without his permission. I pledge that, should there be any future election campaigns for me, I will respect and uphold the rights of artists and obtain permission or a license for the use of any copyrighted work. Thank you.
When Little Creatures was released, David conducted an interview in which he went through all of the songs on the album. About Road to Nowhere, he said, "It's kind of a gospel Cajun march. It's a happy, upbeat song. All these people singing about being on the road to oblivion." Byrne has spoken numerous times about the way music can transmit a feeling or a mood, virtually instantaneously, and it resonates with us instantly and without requiring any processing. We hear music and we just understand when it's angry or sad or romantic and so on. This provides a unique opportunity for the lyrical content to either match the mood of the music or to subvert it. And it's pretty clear what's going on in Road to Nowhere. In 1992, Byrne told Q magazine that it was the first four lines of the opening verse that sparked the idea for the whole song. We don't have to wonder too much what the original concept for the song was, thanks once again to the True Creatures demos. Here's what David, his guitar and his drum machine were laying down as the bare bones of the track, and listen out for the customary placeholder noises where the lyrics weren't written yet.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know it is going, if it comes up, it's the sea.
On the 2005 reissue of Little Creatures, we were treated to an alternate recording of Road to Nowhere, and this version lays out what the band had just after they headed into the studio. Now, of course, the magic of this track is how deceptively simple the melody is and how it keeps building and building as the song goes on. As you can hear, heading into the studio, the song still didn't have its familiar gospel-inspired opening. To achieve that, engineer Eric Thorngren called in singer Lainey Groves to help soften the intro. The singer brought in a number of other singers and, voila, the intro took shape. In an interview with Sound on Sound magazine, Thorngren said, "When I told her the configuration we were looking for, she put together that whole thing. They did real gospel, and the blend of that with Talking Heads really took the song to another place. I was just floored."
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen.
Writing in the liner notes from the Best of Talking Heads compilation album, David Byrne wrote, "The front bit, the white gospel choir, is kind of tacked on because I didn't think the rest of the song was enough. I mean, it was only two chords. So out of embarrassment or shame, I wrote an intro section that had a couple more in it." There's no question the essential elements of the song are pretty rudimentary. So where do all of those amazing colours and textures come from? And how does that gel with the tone that they were setting out to accomplish? When I spoke to Jerry about the album, he called out this song in particular as needing a little more outside assistance than others.
E.T. had some singers that he knew that he had who would come in and fill out Chris and Tina and me singing background parts with it. And, you know, we added, you know, a friend of ours playing accordion, who had a band called Lugaroo, a sort of Cajun band. And that was great because, you know, we always did not want to get sent into like a trap of doing the same thing for too long.
For the accordion line on Road to Nowhere, the band wanted to emulate the Zydeco style of Louisiana native Clifton Chenier, especially the playing style on his cover of the Professor Longhair tune, Etitefi. That was Jimmy McDonald from Lugaroo playing accordion, and there's also percussion from Steve Scales, and Andrew Kadir plays a washboard with a set of spoons to really bring that Americana vibe that David had been chasing while he wrote those songs, and what would become their whole next album, True Stories. The end result is really something else. By the end of the song, David is a hootin' and a hollerin' so much that over the years, whenever he plays this song during his solo set, he often embellishes the climax with this reference to Rawhide. Of course, as we know, MTV viewers were fed a steady diet of Talking Heads videos from this era, and Road to Nowhere is no exception. David directed the music video along with Steven Johnson, and it was nominated for Video of the Year at the 86 MTV Music Video Awards, losing out to the Dire Straits' epic Money for Nothing. It's a really wild video, and although it's not as iconic as something like Once in a Lifetime, it's every bit as impactful, and it might even be their most creative. In fact, rather than having a cohesive thread, the whole video feels like a montage of little fragments, vignettes designed to stimulate the imagination rather than portray anything too deep and meaningful. At around the 3-minute mark, there's some stop-motion animation with crazy stuff flying around the screen, and there's an impossible frenetic energy that live capture just couldn't achieve. This style of animation was a trademark of Steven Johnson's, who also worked with Peter Gabriel on the famous Sledgehammer video. The church depicted in the video is supposedly the same one featured in the movie Kill Bill and in the 1981 film True Confessions. And if you want more obscure film references, then try this one on for size. At one point in the clip, David splashes around in a pool and there's a couple of underwater scenes. All that footage was shot in the backyard of actor Stephen Tobolowsky. You might know him as the annoying old acquaintance of Bill Murray from the movie Groundhog's Day.
Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing! Ned Ryerson, I dated your sister Mary Pat a couple times till you told me not to anymore.
Ned Ryerson?
Bing!
Bing! So did you turn pro with that belly button thing, Ned? No,
Phil, I sell insurance.
What a shock.
Do you have life insurance?
As it turns out, David was working on the script for True Stories with Stephen Tobolowsky at the time, and there's a bunch of wild, wild stories that stem from that, but all of those are for a different time. And now, it's time to hear from you, the listening public, as I read comments about this song from the home of hot takes known as YouTube.com. The music video has over 7 million views, and these are real comments about Road to Nowhere, so here we go. My husband and I walked down the aisle to this song after we were married. Such an important and beautiful song. Timeless, brilliant, classic, progressive, honored, unforgettable. Did I forget anything? When your existential crisis is having an existential crisis, you know you're listening to a David Byrne song. They better play this at my funeral. It's the perfect storm. David Byrne, the era, an antidote to the rubbish that was around at the time. Total genius. If you're a young band starting out, this is the sort of stuff you need to be listening to. I'm High, and this is the greatest thing ever. This song and the album Little Creatures are made of pure, unadulterated love. It is impossible not to get swept up and sing along at the top of your lungs. Road to Nowhere has clearly come to mean so much to so many people over the years. In researching this song, there's scores of people who reference it from movies that they saw in their youth, from the Fred Savage classic Little Monsters to Reality Bites. And you can see its impact in the multitude of covers that are out there. Here's just a little taste.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen. And we're not little children, and we know what we want. And the future is certain, give us time to work it out. We're on a road to nowhere, come on inside. Taking that ride to nowhere, we'll take that ride.
But for the ultimate irony, you can't go past the cover by the Young at Heart Choir, which features singers aged between 73 and 90. Their cover has an irresistible charm and poignancy that exceeds all others.
There's a city in my mind. Come along and take that ride, and it's all right. A little bit faster now. A little bit faster now. It's very far away, but it's growing day by day, and it's all right. A little bit faster now. A little bit faster now. They can tell you what to do, but they'll make a fool of you, and it's all right. A little bit faster now. A little bit faster now.
Wait a minute. We may be lost, but we're making good time.
And to finish off my look at Road to Nowhere, and because it seems that I just can't pass up an opportunity to reference Saturday Night Live, we need to talk about John Mulaney. In 2020, Mulaney hosted Saturday Night Live for the third time, with his new pal David Byrne agreeing to appear as musical guest. On that episode, Mulaney unveiled a sketch called Airport Sushi, the third in a series of musical montages following the previous installments Diner Lobster and Bodega Bathroom. As you may have worked out, in Airport Sushi, a customer makes a questionable food purchase which triggers a series of weird and wonderful musical performances, concluding with David Byrne appearing as an airport marshal as the sketch closes with the ensemble dancing off stage, a casualty of perpetual airline delays.
Man, this airport is its own world.
Yes, a third world.
And if you stay here long enough... And if you stay here long enough, you will learn the mysteries of LaGuardia.
Why, it's the baggage handler who tosses everyone's suitcase into Long Island Sound.
That's right. And you should know that.
We're on a plane to nowhere. Take off. That is a lie.
in addition to the pride of place that this album holds in the hearts of millions of music fans around the world, Little Creatures was voted Best Album of the Year for 1985 in the Village Voice Jazz and Pop Critics poll, and it reached number 10 in the UK album charts. In its review of Little Creatures, the New York Times embraced the new, poppier Talking Heads sound, but it didn't go unnoticed that, at more or less the same time, David Byrne had also released another solo record, this time an art record called The Knee Plays, featuring music that he had composed to accompany the Robert Wilson play The Civil Wars.
In the future, everyone will have the same haircut and the same clothes. In the future, everyone will be very fat from the starchy diet. In the future, everyone
will... All the while, speculation continued to grow that Talking Heads was now a mainstream pop band, and the members were using their various solo careers to explore ideas that didn't gel with the sensibilities of the other band members. As if to prove this theory was 100% right, after the release of Little Creatures and The Knee Plays, David continued plugging away at his upcoming movie project, True Stories. Chris and Tina took a break from music for the most part, having released roughly an album a year for the previous 8 years, and touring for almost a decade. They kept Tom Tom Club on pause and waited for the next Talking Heads project to come along while enjoying their happy family life. That left Jerry, who by now had dabbled in a few side projects and had even begun producing music for other artists. On the back burner for the last few years, Jerry had been writing songs, just sort of chipping away at things here and there, hoping to eventually release a follow-up to his debut album, The Red and the Black. Jerry certainly had some dark days along the way, but his star was about to shine bright. He just didn't know it yet.
Got the heat turned on, and the windows down.
Next time on This Must Be Talking Heads, I sit down with Modern Lover, Talking Head and Casual God, the man himself, Jerry Harrison, to discuss his entire solo career. We go deep into just about everything he's done outside of Talking Heads. So whether you've never checked this stuff out before, or you're just hungry for more, this is going to be an absolute treat. And that's about all I have to say about Talking Heads' sixth studio album, Little Creatures. And as always, I'm going to close out the show with a cover version of a song from the album. By far, the song on this album that's covered the most is Road to Nowhere, but I don't usually like to revisit the hero track at the end of the show, so instead I went with this awesome surf punk cover that not only sounds great, but gets through the tune in about half the usual time of the original. This is Television Man by Man or Astro Man. Out. This song is short, so I'll have to speak fast. Thanks for listening, and if you want to support the show, you can follow my Instagram at This Must Be Talking Heads, you can follow me on Twitter at PodMakingSense, and you can visit my website, which is thismustbetalkingheads.com, to get in touch with me about literally anything, or to pledge a few bucks a month to keep the lights on and get yourself a bunch of bonus goodies via my Patreon. As a special bonus for Patreon supporters, I'll be uploading my entire interview with Jerry Harrison unedited. And although everybody will get the best bits right here for free, if you just can't get enough content to fill your days, there's dozens of hours of exclusive audio and more at the Patreon. And it can all be yours for just a few bucks a month. Okay, this song is literally nearly finished already, so please just do yourself a favor and make sure that you stay subscribed, tell your friends, and even tell strangers on the street about the podcast, because next time is my exclusive and in-depth interview with the incomparable Jerry Harrison.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6! Run, 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 run!
She cried, I can't stand it.
Bombing in 5 minutes.